So we're going to talk about the secondary data. Have any of you already had an idea that you might want to use this in your RNI, or are you just thinking about it generally? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what I'm going to talk about can be data that you want to use as your main resource for your RNI, or data that you can use to kind of background what you're doing if you're doing your own primary data collection. So I think the first thing to say is, what is secondary data? Secondary data is data that's collected by somebody else. And that sounds a bit odd when you've probably heard an awful lot about people going out into the field and collecting their own data. But actually, some of the data sets that we have in this country that other people have collected are absolutely amazing resources. They also cost a huge amount of money. I mean, they range from 5 million upwards. And so the quality of the data that they get is very, very different from anything that you would achieve on your own. So the upside is you're using really, really high quality data. I've just put up a few things, just in case you were wondering what kinds of things you can investigate with this data. These are some facts that come from various secondary data sets from the UK. And head teachers in England are amongst the most satisfied. That comes from an international data set that the UK participated in, run by the OECD, called TALIS. And that has an awful lot of information on how teachers and head teachers feel about teaching in the UK and globally. Children not academically affected by whether their model works for the first year of their life. That comes from the British cohort study, which is something that I'm going to talk about in a bit more detail later, but it's one which followed all the children born in 1 week in 1970 and has followed them throughout their lives. Some of you may have seen a TV program. It's actually not related to the data set, but it's a similar concept called 7-Up, which is like this, like they keep going back to these families and interviewing them every 7 years or so. But it's amazing because we have cohorts that span people born in 1946, 1958, 1970, and millennia babies as well. And they've been followed and are still being followed. So we have people right into old age, and we interviewed them first when they were zero, which is quite remarkable. And then some work that I'm involved in, social mobility, thinking about how your parents' background influences how well you do in life. And again, these are exactly the same kinds of data sets that we've been using to answer those questions. You may not be asking questions like that, but this kind of data is nonetheless really useful to inform what you are doing. So you can access these data, and most of what I'm going to talk about are data that you could go and download tomorrow for free as students. So this is not things that are complicated to get hold of. Why would you want to do that? Well, first of all, I've mentioned this already, it's better quality than anything you'll collect. But it's also big. So one of the challenges of doing your own primary data collection, which is why in education research you end up with, if you take for every 100 theses that you do, 99 of them will be primary data collection, normally involving 1 to 2 schools. And that's because that's what's feasible, especially in a master's or a third year of an undergraduate program. You can't do any more than that. Whereas when you're using these data sets, of course, you've got the advantage that someone's done it for you and you can get stuck into the analysis. So with these data, the challenge is not in collecting the information, it's thinking about how you might use it to ask interesting questions. Okay, so how has it been used and why is it? What are the advantages and the disadvantages? I think the first thing is that obviously if you go out and collect your own data, even if you're doing a PhD, you've still only got a 3-year time period. So you never get to ask long-term questions. You never get to ask questions like, what difference does it make whether you go to a good or a bad nursery on how you feel about life or your self-esteem at the age of 11? Those are not the kinds of questions you can answer if you do your own data collection. Whereas with these ones, because you've got that time span, you can really, really get to the grips with questions like that. The other thing that quite a few people like to do in these data, particularly actually for masters or for third year undergrad, is replicate stuff. So it might be that you've seen something, maybe in a US paper or something you've been reading, and you want to see whether that works here. This is exactly the kind of data that you can use to kind of go and try something that's quite similar to what someone's done before, but see whether it holds in another setting. And I've talked about time and expense collecting data. So what are the disadvantages? They look complicated, that's the first thing. So when you come to look at them, a lot of people go, ooh. And obviously they're not designed for your particular question. Has anyone got any question in mind, even if they haven't worked out what, how they're going to answer it? Any topic that they want to explore particularly, or are you all open-minded at this stage? Anybody?
Some of the secondary data may end up looking at what kinds of educational resources, like toys and games, are most popular.
Right.
In schools, like what they end up buying or what ends up getting used as kind of background information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you were trying to get granular information at school level, well, you know, classroom level, what types of toys, that's probably a primary data collection. You're not going to find that. But if you wanted to look, for example, at the emotional development or cognitive development of children, depending on how much exposure to play they have, you could do that in some of these data sets. That's a kind of illustration of the difference. So there are two types of data that you need to know about. There's cross-section and longitudinal. Cross-section is like taking a photograph. You sort of go out there, you take a photograph of the world, you describe it in data, and you get some insight into what the world is like at the moment. Because it's not following anything over time, sometimes cross-section data doesn't really help you get a causal relationship. So if I want to understand, does play in childhood help you to develop emotional intelligence, I can't do that in cross-section, because all I will observe is children with high levels of emotional intelligence, and then observe they do a lot of playing, but I'm never sure what caused what. But that said, for some of what you're doing, somebody mentioned they wanted it as background. Cross-section data can be really helpful in that respect. So there are two examples there. One is the labor force survey. So for example, I do work on graduates and graduate learning, graduate outcomes. I could use the labor force survey to tell me a little bit about employment rates for female graduates, for example, because it gives me a snapshot of what's happening in the current labor market. Or PISA, the Program for International Student Assessment. If you're doing something, say, from a European country or the UK, and you want to put something in context, and you want to talk about whether the UK is good, bad, or indifferent in reading, or maths, or whatever subject you're looking at, that would be a good data set to turn to. So just to give you a little bit of a kind of picture of what that data would look like, this is PISA. Down the bottom, you've got data on teacher salaries, expressed in dollars to make it comparable across countries. Up the y-axis, you've got the scores on average achieved by those countries in the PISA tests. And this one is mathematics. And you're looking at the relationship between the two. Obviously, it tells you teachers, where teachers are paid more, the test scores are higher. It doesn't necessarily tell you that if you are sitting in Turkey and you double teacher salaries, that you'll necessarily produce a magical improvement in attainment. That's a causal relationship that you might have to look at over time to be sure about. But it does tell you something. And certainly if you were doing, for example, a project on teachers, teachers' motivation, teacher satisfaction, teachers wanting to leave the profession, which I know a couple of people are interested in, this kind of data might help situate either the UK, or you can get this data just for the UK and look within the UK at different types of schools, for example. Do you have, if you've got any questions? And you know, the other thing it's used for, often badly, is rankings of countries. And this is where I think one of the issues around quantitative data comes in. Quantitative data, you need to develop a minimum level of understanding and skill of how to use it. Often when PISA comes out, people use it in ways that you're not supposed to use it. So for example, they assert confidently that Shanghai has far higher scores than, say, Korea. That's not true, actually, in the data, because there's some error, some uncertainty around those estimates, because obviously it's a sample. Yeah, it means that there's a little bit of ambiguity and you have to kind of put confidence intervals on, which if you come, you can learn about those. What you end up saying is, well, actually, it's probably not significantly higher in Shanghai than Korea, but we're pretty confident that Shanghai is higher than the OECD average, for example. So you do need to use these data in sensible ways, But actually, there's a huge amount that you can do with very, very simple descriptive statistics that you will have come across at A level, or if you haven't done maths A level, we have excellent resources in the library to support that, and there's a couple of online things that can give you very, very good guidance to how to produce some basic statistics. So just out of interest, how many EU countries do you think are actually genuinely better than us, England, in maths, science and reading in the last PISA, if you had to guess, from what you probably have read about or heard about in the newspapers if you've been studying education and following education? What's your general impression, given that there are, let me, 30 countries participating? Any stab at how many?
One of the presenters earlier, speakers, said England tends to have around, the UK tends to have around 16th, mm-hmm. and if a handful of them would be non-EU, it may be like 9 or 10 mm-hmm. EU countries were above.
Yep. What
were
you
going to
say?
I was
Right question. Right question. So, when you, if I had total data on all the population, when I say the average test score is 572, that's correct because I've gone out and tested everybody. If I go out and test 200 people and it comes out 572, I don't have the same certainty about that because I could have got a slightly odd sample. So there's a degree of uncertainty. We normally express that with what they call a confidence interval, which is the probability that you're 95% right within a certain range. And when you're very confident that two numbers are statistically significantly different from one another, what it means is I'm sure they're different, taking account of this uncertainty. Mm. So the real answer, despite the newspaper headlines, is actually only three countries, and they're an unusual combination of countries as well. They're not countries, except for Finland, which everybody talks about, they're not countries that jump out at you. So the vast majority of countries in the PISA dataset are not massively dissimilar to one another, and we sit just below the OECD average on reading and science, on the average for reading and science, just below for maths. But it's not the disaster that it would appear, because you're quite right, England is often ranked about 16th or 17th in the list, but actually, in reality, we can only be sure that we're worse than three countries. And then if you ask how many of those countries managed to do that twice, because you might think that if they just had a good year, the answer is just Finland. And if you look at other tests, like there's another one called TIMSS, which is a slightly different test, but also maths and reading, and you ask the sort of sensible question, is Finland really better than us? It looks like it is. It's better in maths, science and reading. It's better over time. Is it better in other tests? At that point, we think, maybe the answer is only in science. So some of these data, you need to be very careful the way you use it and the way you describe it, but nonetheless quite powerful in terms of, for example, looking at gender differences and other things like that, where you can be a lot more confident of the results that you have. So the second type of data is longitudinal. Longitudinal is stuff that changes over time. And that's what I was getting at when I said that if you wanted to explore causal relationships, it might be ideal to observe the person over time to see what's happening to them, normally as a result of something that you're interested in, like preschool or an intervention of some kind. And so you'll see patterns called panel data, longitudinal data, cohort data, slightly different, but basically the same principle that you're following either people or households or firms or some institution over time. And you can obviously have longitudinal data for countries. So if I'm taking PISA, and I'm instead of just looking at a ranking, I'm doing something far more sensible, which is looking at the trajectories of different countries. You've got now three or four time periods you can look over. Then that's longitudinal data from a country perspective. I've said that it gives us a sense of change. The other thing is it allows us, if we collect data during a time period, to look at processes and things that are actually changing either within the individual or within the school. And so for some of you, for example, if you're doing a project that you might be based in a particular location, like a local authority or in a particular school, what you really might be interested in is framing that with some information about the local authority or the school that is over time. And that's all available, very straightforwardly downloaded an Excel spreadsheet. You could look at test scores over time, you could look at the intake of the school over time, proportion of eligible for free school meals over time, you could even look at expenditure, or funding levels rather, in the school over time. So that's longitudinal data, it's at the level of the school, but it's quite straightforward. And certainly when you're making comments, for example, about the findings, say from your primary data collection, maybe you're observing something happening in a school, you're going to feel much better about saying things about that if you can say something about what that school looks like in relation to other schools. Is it the poorest school in the local authority? How does it meet at test scores compared to the rest of the country? Has it got an average free school meal rate? Or around here, has it got a very low free school meal rate? And therefore not very typical of schools in England. Really, before you sort of start to kind of think about saying something that you generalise from your research, you'd need to know that. So why isn't everybody using it? Combination of things. One, people lack analytical and statistical skill, and certainly here you can get oodles of help with it. Did any of you meet Sonia Illy yesterday? Yeah, so she's one, I think Ben Olcott as well. We've got various people who can supervise and provide quantitative expertise for people who need it, and you can go as far as you want with it. You can do sensible things with starting from a relatively low base, or if you've done A-level statistics and mathematics, was your oyster, and you can take it from there. The other problem with longitudinal data is often if you're trying to watch people over time or watch things over time, you're asking them about things that have happened in the intervening period. And you have to be a bit careful with that. So in some of these birth cohorts, for example, they interviewed the mums at 7 and 11. When they got to 11, they were asking retrospective questions about what was happening in that primary school period. So you need to be careful, because obviously people remember things differently. So they're not the answer to everything, but for some questions, they're really good. And what we also find is over time, people drop out of surveys. So we've just done a survey of graduates. Some of you might even have got emails, actually. And I think we're at 50% response rate at the moment, which we're delighted and really, really happy about. So we've got 5,000 graduates that we've managed to hang on to for a year, and that's pretty good. So, but you know, these are difficult things to do, and the survey over time, certain people tend to fall out of surveys, so that's another problem that you need to worry about. So for those of you after this who want to follow up on this, there are a couple of things you might want to go and look at, even if you're not planning to use them, because they'll certainly give you some insights into the kinds of things that people do with this data. They've also got a whole bunch of studies, so that even if you don't want to use the data, you can click and read some of the studies that are related to this data, which you might then cite in your literature. The slides should be on Moodle. If they're not, I'll make sure they are. So the first is the Millennium Cohort Study, and the second is the Longitudinal Study of Young People in England. The Millennium Cohort Study, obviously, is those born in 2000. So for those of you thinking about studying the modern school system, that cohort, sadly, are just sitting there just GCSEs as we speak. That's my son's cohort. So they're literally coming to the end of their compulsory schooling. So that's quite a nice period to study. And the Longitudinal Study of Young People in England is a study of teenagers making the transition into university and into the labour market. So depending on which sort of angle, or whether you're interested in childhood or adolescence, you might want to have a look at either of those data sets. And they're very easy to get to, and those links will take you where you need to go. But I thought what would be most useful for you is to give you some sort of flavour of what you can do with those kinds of data. So these are some examples from my own work, but also from the work of others. One of the first things that came out when the Millennium Cohort Study was produced was that they did this study, and what they were interested in is, we know poor kids have much lower levels of achievement than rich kids. We've known that for a while, but what's less evident is why and when that starts to go wrong. And so what they wanted to look at was, if you take the child as they go through primary, secondary school, where are those gaps emerging, where do they widen? Where do they narrow? So I'll put some little words up and some pictures. Some pretty worrying statistics. Only about 3/4 of the poorest kids get to the expected level at Key Stage 2. compared to almost all kids from the top of the income distribution. And then when you look at five good GCSEs, which is a metric of sorts that might indicate whether you're likely to go to university, for example, or indeed go to an apprenticeship, only around about a fifth of the poorest kids achieve that. And that's a barrier. I mean, that's starting to be a barrier even to get into some FE courses, let alone get into AG courses. So if you want to see what that looks like, they put it all together. So the lineup here is the rich, the lineup here is the poor, and their fifths. So it's, you know, the bottom 20%, et cetera, to the top. These are, broadly speaking, ages. You can ignore the acronyms. Those are the names of the different data sets that they have to combine to pull this picture together. So you can ignore those, but what you can focus on is age 3, age 5, age 7, 11, 14, 16. Okay, and you can see the gaps. And one thing you'll notice is that there's a big gap when the kids start school. So that's really important for us to understand. This is not a situation where poor kids go to bad schools and end up with bad results. They come into school with these. And many of you, this will be really familiar. And the reason why it's really familiar is because over the last 10 years or so, this evidence, particularly from the US, from James Heckman, and from colleagues here in the UK, has started to make its way into thinking, into government thinking. It was behind the increase in the expenditure on nursery provision, for example. It's why people constantly talk about quality of nursery provision. So some of the evidence here kind of finds its way into people regularly talking about the importance of the early years, and that's where it comes from. You'll also notice, however, it widens. Okay, so again, be careful. It doesn't mean that the school system have taken a gap and made it worse. It can also be that the impact of family that is so evident here with these whacking great gaps before you even start becomes even more obvious and negative as the kid goes through to adolescence. What you can say from this picture is that the schools fail to close the gap, so whatever we're doing, it's not sufficient to compensate for the problems that these children have due to other socioeconomic disadvantage. Does that make sense? Do you get it if you've got any questions? So another type of data that I've been using a lot is administrative data. Now, many of the studies that we do, I'm doing one, for example, on graduates' earnings. It's HMRC tax data. You're not going to be able to use that for your R&I. You have to go into a locked room to use it, so generally quite picky about it. However, some of the data I was talking about earlier, about that school level information, that is administrative data. So it's data that's collected not for research, but actually for routine management system, but that you can use for research, and particularly to frame research. So they're often longitudinal over very long periods of time. They're census information, so they have everybody in it. So some of that uncertainty I was talking about goes away, or reduces anyway, when you're using administrative data. But they're often not that detailed. So if you're wanting to look at play in the classroom, they're not going to help you. But if equally, if you wanted to look at school performance, they'd be great. So the data for the UK on that is the National Pupil Database and School Census. If you're interested in higher education, it's Higher Education Statistics Agency. If you're interested in further education, it's the Individual Learner Record. And I'm very fortunate at the moment because I have all of those data sets linked together, so I can follow kids now from age 5 right the way through school, FE, HE, and into the labour market. So you can watch the whole trajectory. Probably not what you're going to do in an R&I, but nonetheless, important to know about. Let me show you what we've done with it. We knew that going to university and the chances of going to university varied massively by someone's socioeconomic background, and that was a given. And because that was a given, there were two or three types of discourses. One was universities need to be better at getting poor students in. The second was we need to make tuition fees lower because it puts off poor students. And the third one was that if poor students can get to university, that's the ultimate goal because it will increase their earnings and improve their social mobility. And we've used these data to show that all three of those are wrong, in the sense that, yes, you're much more likely to go to university if you come from a rich background, but if you take two kids at the point of going to university, which is when most universities get them, say 16, 17, and you take two kids with exactly the same number of available points. You won't recognise the points because it's a different system, but these are kids with 301 plus points, or 181 to 300, etc. So you've grouped the kids by achievement at A level, and then what you're showing is what is the likelihood of going to university if you come from a non-FSM background, so you're not eligible for free school meals. That puts you roughly in the top 70%, 70-80% of the population, or if you're a free school meal pupil, and that put you in the bottom 20-30%. As you can see, tiny gaps, slight gap there, yeah? And more recent work that I've done to update this has shown that the gaps are even smaller. So essentially, two kids from rich and poor backgrounds have the same chance of going to university if, and this is the big if they get the A-level grade. Problem is they don't get the A-level grade. So really, the problem that we're looking at is this one. Yeah, if you want to solve the problem of poor kids going to university, you have to go here and look at that and understand that and know that the gap started early. You might want to go to 11 and say, and it's got worse. Not much point, really, in worrying about whether or not poor kids are applying to university, because if they are applying and they get the grades, they get in. Okay, so that was the kind of finding from that. It's quite interesting. Okay, so for those of you interested in following up, some links there to get you straight into the UK Data Service, which will provide you with access to all this information. On there, you'll see something called teaching data sets. These are data sets that are cut-down versions, deliberately designed to be easy to use, and they come with explanatory material. So if you decide that you don't want to do any data analysis for your RNI, you might still want to think about playing around with one of those. And the reason why I say that is that I'm a trustee of the Nuffield Foundation. They've done a lot of work on this, looking at the value of analytical skills and the value of quantitative skills. And in the labour market, there is a really, really strong demand for people who can do this kind of stuff. So if you get the opportunity, even if you're not going to go and put it in your RNI, to at least start to think about it, you might find that it pays off later on, at least in terms of jobs. You will need SPSS, which is available free in the faculty. And for those of you who are not keen on doing the statistical analysis, there's also qualitative data in there. See you. There's also qualitative data in there too. Some quite interesting things. For example, essays written by kids who were born in the 50s when they were 11, talking about what they wanted to do in life. And similarly, you've got that for the kids who were born in 2000. So some interesting work could be done qualitatively as well. And on that black dot, there is a video, which I won't play now, but it will talk you through some of the resources that you can use. And most of the resources are at the Centre for Longitudinal Studies. It's not the only centre, but it's actually quite accessible. And they're very willing to give help. And if you decide to pursue it, you can email or phone them and get assistance if you need it. So just to convince you that you might want to do that, I'll briefly describe this 1970 cohort that I was talking about. So this is the cohort born in this one week in 1970. And I thought it would be useful to kind of illustrate what you might do with it, because last year there was a student who was very interested in understanding children with emotional difficulties. And she was thinking of doing primary data collection and then came and discovered that actually in some of these data sets you've got this kind of information but at a very large scale. So in the 1970 data set, you have the Rutter behaviour measures. And from that, you can start to think about understanding the relationship between, for example, a student's socioeconomic background and the behaviour or emotional problems that they're having, difficulties in school. You can then also follow them through school and beyond and look at how they're doing as adults. Which is actually quite optimistic, because although many of these kids have problems that led to low attainment in school, many of them then also go on and do well in adulthood. Although on average, of course, worse than someone who didn't have these difficulties. The Rutter measures, to give you some insights, are measures that have been developed by psychologists, tested, validated, they're comparable, the because they're being used in other data sets. So when you write your R&I, you're not sitting there going, I asked this question and I'm not sure why, trying to justify what you put into your survey or justify what you put into your measure. You're actually saying this is an established measure that has validity globally, which gives you a bit more confidence in your research. Those are the kinds of things it asks about. I'm not a psychologist, so I can't tell you the ins and outs of the theoretical underpinnings for why they've asked them in this way. But what they do find is it's very predictive of both education attainment and later outcomes. This is what a data set might look like, and this is why people get a little bit put off, because it all looks a bit weird. You'll have a variable name, which does make sense. It's B for birth. The number normally indicates the age at which the data was collected. And then you've got a name that's supposed to relate to the type of variable you're talking about. Most of the data sets now have dictionaries, which means you can go online, interrogate them. And there's a new thing that's just come out from an organization called Closer, which means that you can go in and interrogate all these data sets simultaneously to find the things that you want to do. Anybody interested in that, just drop me an email. And so these are the kinds of variables you have. And as you can see, it's incredibly rich. Everything from how much the baby weighed when it was born, through to social class of parents, as well as these behavior measures. Okay. So just to end, because I'm conscious that I've been talking an awful lot about UK data. Don't know if any of you are thinking about using either primary data or doing primary data collection in other contexts, so you want to use data from other contexts. But there is data out there that's also available, and obviously for an R&I, you're not generally going to be able to do primary data collection in another country, although some people have. And so it might be worth thinking about whether there's secondary data that you could use. One of the challenges is in the UK, all these data sets are free, and there are organisations that have been set up to try and encourage you to use it, to get a lot of support. In some other countries, access is incredibly difficult. But we have good success in the faculty in a number of different countries, particularly India, Pakistan, and bits of sub-Saharan Africa, where we've got really good data. And if anybody's interested, we can put you in touch with people who can help you use that. And then some data sets, which I would urge you to think about, are international, but still downloadable and accessible to you. And those are the ones that are run by the OECD. So that includes PISA, which we've talked about already, and TALIS, which is the teaching data set. And particularly, any of you doing a teacher-focused R&I, you might want to think, even if you're not going to manipulate the data yourself, go to the TALIS reports. You've got reports for each country. They've got an overall report. You can start talking about English teachers, say you're doing England, in the context of what that looks like globally, and make comparisons, which I think will add to your... Alright. So I've given you all the website links that you need. That's the PISA link, the TALIS link. The other thing, if you're interested in international education and development side of things, as you know, Pauline Rose here is leading on our work in sub-Saharan Africa, and she used to head up the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report, which is a sort of a report that talks about the education systems globally and draws in some of this international data. And that tiny link at the bottom there is the last report that they produced. Again, really useful to provide context to countries if you're doing something international. And then finally, I've also pointed you to the World Inequality Database. A lot of people are quite interested in inequalities of one description or another. That's a database on education that has data globally that can tell you about inequality as well as average achievement. So for example, if you want to know for sure whether or not the UK is as unequal as people often say it is, answer no, it's not, in a global sense, although much worse than Finland, that's the kind of data set that you can use. And it also has inequalities on income and other measures. So all of those are pretty good sources for lots of things that you might want to do. Let me just show you, for example, what the UNESCO report has. I don't know if you can see the text from there, but teaching, perennial issue about quality of teachers and supply of teachers. Now, obviously, we have an issue in this country about the quality and supply of teachers, but it's not on the same scale as you have in other countries. And so what the UNESCO Global Monitoring Report did is try and give some sense of what that actually looks like in different countries. These are mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, because that was where the data is, but you've got some other ones in there, Bangladesh, for example. They're giving the pupil-to-teacher ratio on the left-hand side. So 80 to 1 in Central African Republic, 40 to 1 in Bangladesh, quite scary numbers. To give you some context, the average in this country for secondary is 22, and the average for for primary is 26. So much higher numbers. But the one on the right is the one that's probably even more worrying, which is the ratio of qualified teachers, of pupils to qualified teachers. I think the worst one is so again, Central African Republic at 138 pupils for one qualified teacher. So this is the kind of information that has proved to be quite powerful when it comes to talking to the policymakers about some of the problems. For example, in one third of countries, you've got less than three quarters of teachers actually trained. What does that mean? Putting that in some sort of context, and then maybe doing primary data collection in the country under consideration. Similarly, you can see that for various bits of sub-Saharan Africa. Okay. So before you rush off and do your R&I, I would just urge you to think about three questions, irrespective of what your research question is. First of all, have you decided already to collect primary data? If you have, how can you ensure that you make it the highest quality possible? And more importantly, have you thought about what you can and can't save from the basis of that primary data? Have you thought about using secondary? Try and work out whether there might be an advantage of doing so. More importantly, do you think you actually need both? One of the quickest ways to get a lower grade in your R&I is to assert confidently that the world is this way on the basis of one teacher or one school or one group of pupils. If nothing else, if you take nothing else from this session, be cautious and think of ways that you can use large-scale, representative, high-quality, quantitative data to give you some insights into what it is that you're looking at. Not suggesting you use that as a research method, but simply to give you that framework, that perspective of what your data actually is telling you. If you decide to be brave and go ahead and even do a little bit of exploration for your R&I, I suggest you sort of go and play a little bit with some of these data sets or some of the information that's out there, because you'd be surprised what you can find. And in particular, if the vast majority of you end up doing things in schools or focused on schools, I really would urge you to go and have a look at the Department for Education data. Now, you can access that on the DfE website as though you were a parent going in to choose a school. So you put in DfE school league tables to your Google, comes up, you can put in the name of a school, and a whole bunch of data comes out for that school. I would say if you're doing work in a school, that is an absolute minimum for any R&I to have that information in the report. Yeah, it takes 10 seconds to go and look it out. Now what would be better is to then compare what's in on that school with national averages. And when you're doing that, what you'll notice when you click on the DfE website, down the bottom right-hand side, there's a tiny thing that says download data. You can download all the test scores and everything for every school in England. It takes about 30 seconds to download. And from that, of course, you can then start to think differently. You could, for example, download the data for the local authority that you're working in and then compare your school to the rest of the local authority. So definitely something to think about. And that would give you what I'm talking about in the last bullet, which is a sort of richer description of the primary data that you're actually looking at. There's one. So if you decide that you are, where is it? Sorry, wrong page. Yeah. If you decide that you really would like to use quantitative data and do some statistics, what I would suggest you go and have a look at first is probably this one, because it is a social mobility review, but in the process goes through a lot of different data sets and talks about it in quite a general way. Some of the other references are quite detailed when it comes to the statistics. The other one that's relatively straightforward is the Greg and Goodman, which is the second one down. And again, that's a report from Joseph Roundtree Foundation, and that's quite accessible. They might get you into some of the kind of data sets that we've been talking about. Okay, so that's it for me, but perhaps you've got questions or things that you want to ask about. So if you decide that you need help and your supervisor can't provide that help because your primary interest is something else, then do either email me or Sonia or Ben Alcott, and one of us will be able to point you to the right data set or point you to the right help if you need help with statistics.